So we are in hour 9 of learning the Bible in 24 hours, in which we're going to explore the book of Daniel. Now, we've been through the divided kingdom, Judah, the southern kingdom, Israel, the northern kingdom. We're going to focus on the trailing end of that when they go into the Babylonian captivity, and of the prophets there, of course, it's Daniel that we're going to focus on. The book of Daniel. It's 12 chapters divided into two parts. The first 6 chapters are historical. They're actually narratives of a dream, the fiery furnace, Nebuchadnezzar's ego trip, the fall of Babylon, as they're recorded, and the revolt of the Magi. Strangely enough, that may surprise you. Many people don't really understand who the Magi were. And the last half of the book, the last 6 chapters, are his prophecies. And the times of the Gentiles, the unique part of the Bible is focused on the Gentiles. Daniel 2, 7, and 8 deal with that. The most astonishing passage in the entire scripture is Daniel 9. We'll take a look at that. And then the dark side of spiritual warfare in chapter 10 in the final consummation. The book of Daniel. And chapter 1 is a deportation where Daniel as a teenager is deported. And he's deported to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar has a strange dream that changes the course of history. And we'll go right through the 6 chapters that are really a narrative, quite colorful, quite dramatic. Daniel always fascinated. There's 2 guys in the scripture of which no evil is spoken of, besides Christ, of course. 2 guys, Joseph and Daniel. And they were both executives. They're both professional administrators. I think that's interesting. For those of us that have had third-party stewardship, I think that's very interesting. Daniel's one of the 2 men that there's no evil spoken of. Now, as we looked at our panorama of history, from the creation to the present day, we're now going to focus on the period of what's called the exile, when the nation is in captivity. And specifically, the Babylonian Empire is extant. And we're going to, from the first siege of 3 sieges of Nebuchadnezzar, that starts the servitude of the nation, where the nation Israel is taken captive. Called the servitude of the nation, the last 70 years. There's a second siege where they rebel, and Nebuchadnezzar has to put them down a second time and replace the vassal king. Puts Zedekiah in charge, and he also gets on an ego trip, tries to rebel. Nebuchadnezzar by now has had a bellyful of the whole operation. His 3rd siege, he levels Jerusalem. And that starts a 70 period called the Desolations of Jerusalem. These 2 periods are both 70 years to the day, but they're not coterminous. The first, the servitude of the nation starts with the first siege, the desolations from the 3rd siege. And that has profound implications that we'll look at later. And of course, it's the decree of Cyrus when the Persian Empire takes over Babylon. Cyrus finds a letter written to him in the book of Isaiah that Daniel presents to him. He's impressed. He sets a decree ending the servitude of the nation, but that does not end the desolations of Jerusalem. That's the Persian Empire beginning. It's some 19 years later that Artaxerxes sets his decree that allows them to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, and that triggers the prophecy of the 70 weeks of Daniel. And these distinctives are worth knowing because they will lead to the most astonishing passages in the scripture that we'll be looking at as we explore. The 2 Chronicles, of course, finished with the Babylonian captivity. That leads to the post-exile books, Ezra and Nehemiah, and subsequently Esther. Daniel, of course, is deported in the first siege. He's a teenager. He and his 3 friends are among those that are deported by Nebuchadnezzar's hostages to make sure that the vassal king put installed will be loyal. And he was probably of the royal line, by the way. But Ezekiel is deported in the second siege, and he also prophesies from Babylon. Jeremiah is prophesying from Jerusalem during this period. And Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi will be prophets that are subsequent. But we'll go in and take a look at Daniel. Daniel chapter 1, and your challenge is to dare to be a Daniel. Daniel, by the way, is the most authenticated book in the Old Testament. We could spend much time on that. I won't bother because Jesus Christ himself authenticates Daniel. When 4 disciples came to Jesus for a confidential briefing on a second coming, he speaks of Daniel the prophet. So those of you that believe in Jesus Christ don't have to worry about who authored Daniel. Jesus told you. Those of you that don't believe in Jesus Christ have much bigger problems than the authorship of Daniel. So we'll go on. Daniel and his 3 friends are deported in the first siege, as I indicated. They're teenagers at the time. They committed themselves to remain faithful to their form of worship despite the enforced pagan environment. Let's take a note of that as we suffer our children to go to government schools where they're in an enforced pagan environment. Interesting parallel to think about. Daniel and his 3 friends. Daniel's name means God is my judge. He's renamed. He's given a Babylonian name, Belteshazzar. Don't confuse him with another king that's called Belshazzar that we'll talk about. Generally, we'll continue to use his Israeli name, Daniel. But his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, most of us don't know well. We know them by their Babylonian names. They're renamed Shadrach, which means illumined of the sun god. And Mishael is renamed Meshach, which means who is like unto the moon god. And Azariah is renamed Abednego, servant of Nego, or shining fire. So these three friends of Daniel are immortalized in some of our songs, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, rather than their Israeli names, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. But in any case, they vow to stay faithful, and they do try. They get special permission to stay on their own diet and that sort of thing. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's a young guy. His father, Nabopolassar, is the one that was king of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar was his general, his son. He was his son and his general. Nebuchadnezzar defeats a number of city-states, but the big monumental battle is the battle at Carchemish, where he defeats Pharaoh Necho. And that means that now Babylon is the dominant power in the region. And so on the way home, he decides to lay siege to Jerusalem to get an extra trophy. During that siege, he learns that his father has passed away. So this young lad, who's the general, and is now the king of Babylon. So he installs a vassal king after succeeding at the siege and goes home. So he accedes to the throne of Babylon upon Nabopolassar's death. Now this means that this young king inherits the staff advisors of his father, these codgers that he's not sure can cut the mustard one way or the other. One night, Nebuchadnezzar, the young man, has a disturbing dream at night. And so he uses this dream that's bothering him as a test. He's going to try to find out whether these staff guys can cut the mustard, because he insists that they tell him what the dream was and what it means. And they're kind of unglued with that as a chore, because if Nebuchadnezzar will tell him the dream, you know, they'll consult their library of Sigmund Freud and tell him what the dream meant, no problem. But and I'm being facetious, of course. But the point is, they point out to the king, no king asks their people to tell him what the dream was without telling him what the dream was. And Nebuchadnezzar says, "You're just stalling for time. Off, you know, we're going to just." He orders them all killed. That whole job description wiped out. He knew how to reduce headcount when he had a budget problem. So the word goes out for them all to be killed. Now Daniel happens to be, he and his gang are in that job classification. So they, when they hear about this, they go to their supervisor Arioch and says, "Hey, why so hasty? Give us a chance at it." So he agrees to give them an extra day. And so Daniel and his three buddies say, "We got a prayer meeting tonight that won't quit, you know." And so they gather and go to prayer, and God does indeed give Daniel the insight. And then he goes in. Daniel chapter 2 is one of these great, great chapters, because Daniel goes in there, and get the throne room scene here. All the staff advisors are in the back row who've been upstage. And here this young upstart kid says, "King, there is no man that can do what you ask, but there's a God in heaven that can. And we have the dream." And Daniel then tells Nebuchadnezzar what his dream was, which is a pretty weird dream I'll show you in a minute, but then also interprets it for us. We don't have to guess what it means. Daniel interprets it for us. And all this is in Daniel chapter 2. What Nebuchadnezzar apparently saw was an image of a man. And he had a head of gold, arms and chest of silver, bellies and thighs of brass, legs of iron, and the feet were iron but mixed with clay, miry clay. Now, don't confuse. There's not five. There's four parts here: gold, silver, brass, and iron. The iron has sort of a second phase of iron mixed with clay. Now, we know from Daniel's interpretation that the head of gold represents Babylon. Daniel tells him, you are the head of gold. But goes on to explain that you're going to be replaced by another empire, which, of course, turns out to be Persia later in the book. And that, in turn, will be replaced by an empire of Greece. And then there will be a final terrible world empire. It's going to be Rome in two phases, and I'll come back to that later to explain. But as Nebuchadnezzar saw this multi-metalled man, by the way, most scholars recognize that the last two parts are two phases of the same empire. But a stone cut without hand strikes the image at the feet, it all crumbles, and a mountain grows out of that stone that fills the whole earth. Now, that's a pretty weird dream. If you had a dream like that, you'd be pretty puzzled, too. Well, What we're seeing, and of course what we have here is the stone cut without hands is none other than the Messiah, and the mountain that fills the whole earth, of course, is God's own kingdom that gets set up. The man represents a timeline. I'll come back to this when we get to Daniel 7. Daniel 2 through Daniel 7 changes languages. The second verse of Daniel 2 switches from Hebrew to the Gentile language of that day, which was Aramaic, not Hebrew. It's interesting that the Bible generally portrays both history and future history prophecy through the lens of Israel. But there's an exception. And Daniel 2 through Daniel 7 is just that, such an exception. It's a rare glimpse in the Word of God directly of Gentile history in advance. And this vision, and another one we're going to look at, lays out all the world kingdoms from Daniel's day until that day when God interrupts history to set up his own kingdom. It's all laid out. And they're not seven empires or three. There's exactly four, but the fourth one in two phases. And we'll look at that. This period of time from Nebuchadnezzar to the Antichrist has a distinctive label in the scripture called the times of the Gentiles, that when the Gentiles are in dominion. It began with Nebuchadnezzar and will end when the coming world leader, by whatever name you want to use, he has 33 different titles in the Old Testament, he is displaced by the return of the Lion of the tribe of Judah and the Root of David, the Messiah. Now, that's a pretty interesting vision. That all takes place in Daniel 2. When you get to Daniel chapter 3, by this time, Nebuchadnezzar has gotten on an ego trip. And so he orders an image built, but not out of all these different metals. The entire image is out of gold. It's 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. And he enforces an edict that when the music plays, everybody is to bow down and worship this image. I assume that the staff advisors that had been upstage in Daniel 2 somehow inveigle this specifically to entangle Daniel's friends, because they know these kids will not yield and bow down to a foreign idol. So, of course, Daniel's three friends refuse to bow down, and they're given a second chance. And they, in effect, say that our God is able to deliver us. But even if he doesn't, up yours, O king. And so Nebuchadnezzar orders the furnaces, and by the way, they've discovered furnaces of this kind that are used for these purposes archaeologically, but the furnaces are heated to 7 times their normal heat. Even the guards involved get burned up in the process, interestingly enough. And the three guys get thrown into this furnace, and Nebuchadnezzar is curious to watch what happens, and he looks in there, and he's startled because he sees not 3, but 4 people in the furnace. And they're unharmed. The only thing that's burned are their bindings. And who do you think the fourth person was? Designated as the Son of God. There's an Old Testament appearance of Jesus Christ. There's many of them. From this experience, of course, they're brought out and they're unharmed and so forth. There are many prophecy buffs that like to make conjectures that this is a foreshadowing of another time when the world leader will have an image and force the world to worship the image. And so many people see Nebuchadnezzar, at least in this episode, as a type or a foreshadowing of the Antichrist and the image, and the world forced to, at penalty of death, to worship that image. And these three young Jewish men are viewed by some as representing the 144,000 evangelists that are supernaturally sealed in Revelation chapter 7 and all of that. Well, if that's the case, one of the questions you have to ask yourself, let's assume that's valid, I think it might be, and you look at Daniel 3, one of the questions you ask that shows up here is, where was Daniel? What's noticeable in Daniel chapter 3 is no mention of Daniel. Now, there's several possibilities. One is that Daniel is not mentioned because he did bow down and worship the image. How many think that's a possibility? I certainly do not. Okay. The other possibility is that Daniel also refused to bow down, but his enemies didn't accuse him. I don't think that's a possibility either. I'll tell you what I think really happened. Daniel was probably on a foreign assignment for the king, and he was absent, and that's why his enemies took advantage of this opportunity to try to get Daniel's three friends accused. But Daniel's not there. And I sometimes ponder the possibility that Daniel is a type of the church. It's interesting that he's absent. He's absent from the whole experience. Well, we won't build doctrine on that. We'll note it with great curiosity. Let's go to chapter 4, where Nebuchadnezzar... Did you know that Daniel chapter 4 was written by a Gentile? Daniel chapter 4 is written by Nebuchadnezzar himself. It's his testimony. He publishes this memo and has it posted throughout the entire known world to him. And he describes exactly what happened. Nebuchadnezzar does, not Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar. It turns out that he has a second dream. It's a strange dream where a great tree is hewn down for 7 years. I won't go through all the details. And Daniel interprets it, that great tree is Nebuchadnezzar. It's a year later that Nebuchadnezzar is still on this big ego trip. He's walking on the ramparts, proud of this incredible city called Babylon. And through that pride, he is stricken specifically with a mental illness. He becomes mentally deranged for 7 years. It's a fulfillment of the dream. For 7 years, he is mentally incapacitated to serve as king. The Talmud indicates that during those 7 years, do you know who took care of Nebuchadnezzar when he had to have a nurse? Daniel. He had become great friends with Nebuchadnezzar. We have lots of evidence of that from other passages. At the end of the 7 years, Nebuchadnezzar, on schedule, recovers, and he realizes this is all a fulfillment of the dream he had. And he realizes the God of Daniel really is the God of heaven and earth. And he publishes his testimony of receiving that throughout the known world. And that's Daniel chapter 4. And he subsequently dies, and we'll get to what happens subsequently. But when I get to heaven, I personally expect to find Nebuchadnezzar there. I think that he will be there among us. I won't go through all. Nabopolassar was the original king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. He's followed by a series of characters. When you get down to Nabonidus, about 553, Nabonidus has a son, Belshazzar, that's a co-regent with him. A lot of confusion about that, because Nabonidus, while he was king of Babylon, had no interest in Babylon. He was off in Arabia and other intrigues. He really left the throne for his viceroy, Belshazzar. And that explains a lot of strange allusions from archaeological history I won't bore you with here. But let's talk about Daniel chapter 5. It's a major milestone in world history. Belshazzar, that's Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, it turns out, the Persians have risen in power, and they're on the horizon. They've taken over several of the outlying cities of the Babylonian Empire. So Belshazzar should be defending the capital. But it is regarded by the experts as impregnable. It had walls that had room on top for four chariots to race abreast. It was 15 miles on a side. It straddled the Euphrates River. The river not only provided the water for the moats, a double moat around it, but also provided the water in case of a siege. Military experts of the day regarded the city of Babylon as impregnable. Belshazzar, stupidly, presumptuously, instead of defending the threat from the Persians, throws a party for 1,000 nobles in a room which, by the way, Saddam Hussein has reconstructed. Anyway, Persian army's on the near horizon. And while they're partying, Belshazzar does another stupid thing. He sends across the street to the museum where Nebuchadnezzar, his grandfather, 70 years ago, put the temple vessels when Jerusalem was leveled. And he has them bring those sacred vessels to the party to use in the celebration. You think that made God upset? You betcha. And as they're having this party, on the wall, they see the fingers of a man's hand writing on the wall. And this has caused, it's funny, there's a half a dozen different phrases out of the book of Daniel we use every day. You see the handwriting on the wall, we say that. Where does it come from? It comes from Daniel 5. You know, the number, your number is up. You've been weighed and found wanting. All this come out of Daniel. There's a handful of these all come out of Daniel. Anyway, yeah, the idol has clay feet. We use that expression. All comes out of Daniel. It's amazing how many of these idioms from this one book still linger in the language today. In any case, these fingers are writing on the wall. All the experts can't read it. Now, that's surprising. We have these Jewish experts that cannot read this Jewish writing on the wall. But the king, the queen, which I believe is the widowed the widow of Nebuchadnezzar is still alive, and she remembers that when her husband was alive, there was a guy in the kingdom, he's now in retirement, that had a gift of interpretation. So they call Daniel out of retirement, and Belshazzar offers him robes and gold and all the super stuff he'll interpret. And Daniel comes in there. It's a great scene. I wish I had the time to really give it to you verbatim. But he says, you keep your rewards. Now, your father, or grandfather, I mean, he means grandfather. Now, there was a king, and he talks positively about him. Not you, squirt, in effect, okay? But then he turns to the wall and he interprets what's on the wall. And now what they did not know while this is going on is the entire Persian army was able to slip under the wall. You see what Cyrus had his general do. Ugburu was sent a division upriver. And at a pre-appointed time, they diverted the Euphrates into other channels, which brought the water level down below the bars on the gates, and they just slipped the army under the bars of the gate. They took over the city without a battle. If you go to the London Museum, you can see the Steel of Cyrus, where Cyrus brags that he took over Babylon, the capital of the world, without a battle. It took 3 days for some of the residents to even discover that the Persians took over. Babylon was not destroyed, is a very key point that I'll come to later. Now, when we get to this scene, you got to remember this is going to turn out to be the oldest recorded use of cryptographic writing in history. People ask, are there hidden codes in the Bible? Absolutely. Proverbs 25:2, it says, it is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings to search out a matter. Unless you're a student of cryptography, you probably would not be aware of the fact there's several classic ways of encrypting Hebrew. If you take the Hebrew alphabet and lay it, take half of 11 of the 22 letters and slide it over so that you have the alphabet slipped on itself, and then substitute. Whenever you have an aleph, you use a lambda. In other words, you transpose the letters you're using. That's a form of encrypt transposition called albam for the first and last letters. There's another form of encryption where you fold the alphabet back on itself and transpose called atbash. According to the Talmud, and by the way, I'm sparing you the long version, each of these forms of encryption are famous among cryptographers because they are used in the Jeremiah and Isaiah in some classic passages. Now, if you're a student of cryptography or have been, if you're in that career field, you've discovered this from history, and you simply look at them as a historical oddity that in the Bible there are encryptions. On the other hand, if you have a supernatural view of the origin of the Bible and there are codes in the Bible, that's a signpost of extreme significance, and I won't build on that except to point out that, anyway, atbash is the form of transposition that the Talmud says was used in Daniel 5, the handwriting on the wall. In other words, this is what probably was being written on the wall as you see it on your screen. But they couldn't interpret that. It made no sense. But if you transpose those letters against form of atbash, it then reads as follows. Many, many, tekel, upharsin. Now remember, the ancient alphabets had no vowels. By the way, one of the things you do when you encrypt, all encryption is broken by the use of redundancy, and vowels are redundant. 75% of English is redundant. It's the vowels. You get rid of the vowels before you transpose, encrypt, and it gets rid of a lot of the ability to break the code. But in any case, the ancient alphabets were consonants only, so you inferred the vowels. Many, many, not many means numbered or reckoned. And Daniel interprets what that means. God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it, or we would say your number is up. Tekel means weighed, and Daniel interprets that as saying, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. The final word is Perez. You'll see it translated in King James, Upharsin, because the U is simply the and the Pharsin is the plural version of Perez. But anyway, Perez means broken or divided. And Daniel interprets this, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. So Daniel reads this handwriting on the wall and shocks them by saying, your number is up, you've been weighed in the balance and found wanting, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Now, by the way, Perez, if you infer a different vowel instead of the E and an A, and Perez is also the Aramaic word for Persians, interestingly enough. So this, while all this is going on, they don't know it. While they're partying, the Persians are quietly taking over the city, and Daniel is announcing it there on the wall. Interesting time. Now, I want you to understand that Babylon was not destroyed. Many people assume that Babylon was destroyed in 539 B.C. No, it fell to the Persians. 200 years later, when the Persians get conquered by the Greeks make Babylon their capital. Alexander the Great makes it his capital. He dies there. Babylon was not, the fall of Babylon was in 539. The destruction of Babylon hasn't happened yet. Let's go to Daniel chapter 6, which is the lion's den. But I'm going to call it the revolt of the Magi because most people don't understand what's really going on there. By the time you get to Daniel 6, Daniel's about 83 years old, and he's very prominent in the succeeding empire. This is unusual. Daniel was the number two guy in the Babylonian empire. When he gets taken over by the Persians, Daniel's skill and obvious qualities rise him to be the number three ruler in the Persian empire. Among the things, the jobs he was appointed to by Darius, is he was appointed Ragmag, the chief of the Magi. Now, what are the Magi? In the Persian Empire, the Magi were a hereditary sect of the Median priest magistrates. There was a strange type of priest magistrate in that empire that was hereditary. You had to be a Mede to qualify to be in this very select group called the Magi. That's where we get the word magistrate. They were religious, and yet they also had administrative power. In fact, they appointed the king. The Magi together were kingmakers. Well, Darius appoints Daniel to be in charge of these guys. Now, picture these guys. They're very proud of their heritage. They're not Jews. They're Medes. We would call them today, we'd call them Kurds. But their boss appoints this Jew in charge. How do you think that went over? Not very well. Well, these guys, these jealous rivals, entrapped Darius to execute an order which required Daniel, by not obviously not complying to that, to be put in the lion's den. Even Darius is upset when he realizes what they've done, but it turns out by their law he can't change a law he signed. We'll run into that in the book of Esther also. So unfortunately Darius is stuck with the situation that he has to, under his own edict, put Daniel in the lion's den. And Darius is most concerned. He's the one that waits all night hoping that nothing will happen. Of course, the next morning, Daniel's just fine, as you all know. And so he's miraculously spared. What most people don't know is Daniel also, while he was in charge of all this, founded a secret sect within the Magi to preserve a prophecy. And we're going to run into that in the Gospel of Matthew, when these Magi will be led to a manger in Bethlehem. Now, when the Magi visit, of course, most people don't understand. They weren't three guys. Everybody assumes the tradition says there were three because there were three different gifts, gold, myrrh, and frankincense. No. They came with cavalry. They were representatives of the Parthian Empire. Judea was uninhabitable. Herod was appointed king, but he had to stay in Rome because it was too dangerous. Judea was a buffer state between Rome and the Parthian Empire. They finally got strong enough that Herod was there. But when this armed escort arrives in town from the Parthian Empire, and they come up to him and say, "Where is he that's born king of the Jews?" That's a put-down, because Herod was any man. He was appointed by Rome. But he yields to these guys, and he has his scribes check. It's Micah 5:2. It's going to be in Bethlehem. They go off to Bethlehem. But he was nervous. They didn't know that this was going to be some kind of border incident as it occurred before. But we'll get into that when we get into Matthew. Well, we've been through a very quick survey of the six historical parts of Daniel. Let's take a look at the last six chapters that are prophetic. In chapter 7, Daniel personally gets a vision that we'll look at, and there's a number of other visions. We'll look particularly, especially at Daniel chapter 9, too. Let's take Daniel 7, but let's put it in the context of Daniel 2, because they both relate to each other. We have here a biblical view of history. Usually it's through the lens of Israel, but here we have an exception. Daniel 2 through 7, as I said, is in Aramaic. All of Gentile history is an overview, and there are only four empires involved, although the fourth is in two phases. We looked in Daniel chapter 2 at this strange metallic image, gold, silver, brass, iron, and iron mixed with clay. That was a vision given to a man. It's the view of all world empires from man's point of view as a bright, shiny image. And we identify them as Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome in two phases. In Daniel chapter 7, God gives Daniel the same information in a different set of idioms. Daniel gets a vision of the same information, but in terms of a series of voracious beasts. That's how God sees these empires. He sees, this is just a vision, understand, out of the sea a winged lion come that represents Babylon. And he's succeeded by a bear that rises up on one side. And he in turn is succeeded by a leopard that moves so fast he doesn't even seem to touch the earth. That grows four horns and all this, and four heads. The next one, the fourth one, he can't even think of an animal to pair. He just calls it the great and terrible beast. And this one has 10 heads and goes into a phase of is final. Now, if you get into the details here, most scholars recognize the last two parts are not a separate empire, but two phases of the same empire, and there's some reasons for that. But the point is, we're looking in both cases at a timeline of world empires. In one case, how man sees it, bright and shiny image. The other is God sees it as a series of beasts. But the main point is history is laid out in advance. And the iron mixed with clay is a whole other study. What is the clay? And you really won't understand that unless you understand Genesis 6. and the fact that there's going to be some kind of strange hybrids that are involved in world government, it would seem. But we don't have time to get into all those technicalities. Let's stand back and take a good look at this fourth empire. Let's call it the Roman Empire Phase 1. It emerges about 68 B.C. In 44 B.C., Julius Caesar is assassinated. You get to the Battle of Actium in 31 B.C. And in 64 A.D. is when Nero, of course, begins his persecutions. And Diocletian in 284 divides the empire into two parts, the two legs perhaps. 312 A.D., Constantine moves the entire capital of the world from Rome to Byzantium, which becomes Constantinople. And in 476, the empire breaks into pieces. Now, it's kind of interesting. Babylon was conquered by whom? The Persians. The Persians were conquered by whom? The Greeks, just like the prophecy said. Who conquered the Greeks? Rome. Question, who conquered Rome? Answer, no one. It breaks up into pieces. Each of these pieces has had its day in the sun. The Dutch had their day. The British had their day as the mistress of seas. Germany had it twice under Bismarck and then under Hitler. Spain had their Spanish Armada. If you look at each the whole right up through the 16th, 17th centuries, it's Northern Europe and all the different pieces. But what the prophecy implies is that these pieces in the end times were going to come back together and reunite into what scholars like to call the revived Roman Empire. Could that be going on today? We'll look at that when we get to Revelation. Daniel chapter 8, the ram and the he-goat. This is 2 years after the vision of seven and about 12 years before the fall of Daniel 5. Realize these chapters are not in chronological order. All the prophecies are collected at the end. The ram, of course, is defeated by the goat from the west. This is the notable horn of the goat divides into four, and the little horn has a key role at the end. Now, Daniel interprets this for us. The leader from the west is Alexander the Great, and will subdue the Medo-Persian Empire. Cyrus was actually part Mede, part Persian. He set up the previous empire. For two centuries it survives, but Alexander the Great, of course, defeats it, subdues it. In the vision, the four heads are shown. It's interesting, Alexander dies, they say, who does the empire go? He says, give it to the strong. Pretty dumb succession plan. The four generals divide the world up. Alexander has conquered the world all the way to India. It's an incredible story. We're just glossing over here to get through this. But anyways, four generals. Cassander takes over Macedonia and Greece. Lysimachus takes over Thrace, Bithynia, and most of Asia Minor. Ptolemy takes over Egypt, Cyrene, and the Arabia Petraea. And Seleucus takes over Syria and the lands to the east, all the way to India. Now, Ptolemy and Seleucus are the ones who are biblically interested because Judea is between these two portions, and these two dynasties, Ptolemy and Seleucus, fight continually over Judea. And there's the whole history of that struggle is laid out in Daniel 11 with such detail that the skeptics have said Daniel must have been written later, but we can disprove that in an interesting way. And Antiochus Epiphanes will appear as the little horn in this scene, and we'll let that go because it's a much more important passage that I want to take the time for us to get into. Daniel chapter 9, the most amazing passage in the entire Bible. But before we get in, one thing you need to know before we get in that. Here's this timeline again. About three centuries before Christ, the ancient Hebrew text was sometimes called by the scholars the Forlaga. Alexander the Great had conquered the world during the Greek Empire and enforced Greek as the international language. If you were a Jew growing up in that period of time, you probably did not speak Hebrew. You spoke Greek. If you knew Hebrew at all, you would use it much the way today a Catholic might use Latin, just for certain ceremonial purposes. So if you were Jewish in that era, you had a hunger for your scriptures, but your scriptures were in Hebrew, and your facility in Hebrew is very limited. So to solve this problem, in Alexandria, which was a major cultural center in that world, in that period of time, Ptolemy Philadelphus sponsors the translation of all the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. They impaneled some 70, some say 72 scholars, the best Hebrew scholars that they could find. They're impaneled for 15 years, starting about 285 B.C., finishing their main product about 270 B.C. It's the translation of the Old Testament into Greek. We have copies of it. And it's called the Septuagint version of the Old Testament. Septuagint's just a fancy word for 70. The Septuagint in Greek is usually abbreviated LXX. That's 70 in the Roman numerals. The Septuagint, the Greek is a very precise language. We're very grateful for that, because here we have the greatest Hebrew experts of that day, 3 centuries before Christ, translating their scriptures into a precise language called Greek. So the Septuagint is a precious, precious treasure. Here's the point. The book of Daniel is part of the Old Testament, which means the book of Daniel is part of the Septuagint. So if you want to argue who wrote Daniel, fine. It's in black and white, 270 years before the birth of Christ. That's a hard point you can verify in any competent encyclopedia. So there's 270 years anticipation of the birth of Christ. All these Old Testament prophecies we're going to talk about during the session and other sessions were documented in black and white virtually 3 centuries before the fact. Now, Jesus had 4 disciples come to him for a confidential briefing on his second coming. And it's so important that, his response to those 4 disciples, this confidential briefing, is recorded in 3 of the Gospels. Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. But the key to the entire briefing is verse 15 of Matthew 24, where Jesus himself says, "When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whosoever readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains," and so on. How many of you could read that on the screen when I just read that? Can you see that all right? I played a dirty trick on you. See what Jesus said, "Whosoever readeth, let him understand." You see, this passage isn't for pastors or theologians, it's for you. Jesus intended his disciples to understand this rather technical passage. And he's pointing them to Daniel chapter 9, sometimes called the interrupted prayer. The first 19 verses of Daniel chapter 9, we don't have time to detail, but I've got to give you the quick picture. Daniel was reading Jeremiah, in which Jeremiah prophesied that the Babylonian captivity would last 70 years. And Daniel knew that about 67 of the 70 years had passed by. He knew it was about up. Daniel does a very interesting thing. You know what he does about that? He prays for the captivity to end. Now, that simply sounds strange. Gee, if God predicted it, it's certain. Why do we have to pray for it? Because that's God's way. Prayer is not something that you want. Prayer is God's way of enlisting you in what God is doing. And so Daniel goes into this prayer. We do this too, that when it's the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come." Is the Lord coming soon? Well, then pray for it, because your prayer is tied to it happening. But Daniel's prayer is so vivid, I wish I had time to go into it. You can actually, even in the English translation, you can feel Daniel tremble as he prays for the sins of his people, and he gets into it. The frequency of the verbs start picking up. You can almost feel him go unstable. When right at the climax, his prayer is interrupted. He has an interesting visitor, a guy by the name of Gabriel. You know, it's interesting, there's a couple of these super angels, Gabriel and Michael, that have names, first of all. We know what their names are. Secondly, they have job descriptions. They're very specific what they're assigned. Michael is always a military commander on behalf of Israel, every time you see him. Gabriel is always a messenger on a messianic mission, announcing something about the Messiah. Whether it's to Daniel here or Mary later, it's the same situation. Now, Gabriel comes and gives Daniel 4 verses that are the most astonishing 4 verses in the Bible. They're known as the 70 weeks of Daniel. Daniel 9, 24 to 27. Those are the last 4 verses of Daniel chapter 9. And we're going to try to get into those very quickly. The first of the 4 verses is the scope of the whole thing. The next verse, in verse 25, is 69 of these 70 weeks of years. Then there's an interval expressly specified in verse 26. And the final week of years, called the 70th week of the 70 weeks, is verse 27. That's the structure. Pretty obvious if you look at it. Very clear, no controversy. Let's talk about the scope. What Gabriel says to Daniel, 77s are determined upon thy people in the holy city. Let's stop right here. If I told you I can't come back to this place for a decade, when would you expect me? But yes, about 10 years from now. I didn't say years, I said decade. See, you and I presume when I say decade, I mean 10 years. In the Jewish community, they have weeks of days, weeks, months, and years. You may not realize that. We're all familiar with a week of days, but they also have a week of weeks. That's what Shavuot is all about. You also have a week of months from Nisan to Tishri in the calendar. You also have a week of years. 6 years you can plow the land. The seventh, it has a Sabbath for the land. So the idea of, and when Jacob works for Laban, for both Leah and Rachel, he fulfills their week. That's the 7 years of servitude. So 77s is a Jewish way of speaking of 70 weeks of years, are determined or reckoned. Upon whom? Notice this, that many people who write about this fail to understand what it's focusing on. 77 are determined on whom? Upon thy people and the holy city. What is Gabriel talking about? The Jews, Israel, the holy city, not the church or anything else. This is a Jewish thing. To accomplish six things. To finish the transgressions, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and the prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. Wow. We could spend a lot of time arguing what these may include, but I want to just make one point. Have these things happened yet? Not so you'd notice. Have we finished transgressing? Pick up the daily newspaper. Have we made an end of sins? Not so you notice. Is that over? I don't think so. To make reconciliation for iniquity, you could argue that happened at the cross. Let's leave that one. To bring in everlasting rights, do we have everlasting righteousness brought in? I don't think so. To seal up vision and prophecy, and the most holy. In other words, whatever this includes, these 77s are conclusive. When they're done, it's done. I mean, they're obviously not over yet. It involves things that have not yet happened. Okay, that's verse 24. That's the scope of the whole thing. Pretty broad prophecy. The next verse deals with 69 of these weeks. Gabriel says, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Mashiach Nagid, the Messiah, the King." Now, by the way, realize where they are. They're in Babylon. Jerusalem is about 200 miles to the west in rubble. But Daniel just finished reading Jeremiah, and he knows the 70 years captivity are about up. By the way, whenever you see someone in the Bible reading the Bible, they always take it literally. No symbolism, literally. Jeremiah said 70 years captivity. Daniel figures God says what he means and means what he says. He takes it literally. But now Gabriel's saying, so Daniel can understand that there's going to be a commandment eventually. It's going to let them go back and rebuild the city of Jerusalem. Gabriel says, from the going forth the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the King. Boy, that's what they've been looking for centuries. Shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. 7 and then 62. 7 and 62 adds up to 69. For reasons that we can guess about, the 7 are set aside. There's 7 weeks, 49 years, and then 62 weeks. Most scholars assume that 49 years are the time it took to rebuild the temple. That was built before the city was finished. Shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. And the street shall be built. I should say it was started before the city. It wasn't finished till later. But anyway, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall even in troubled times. Now, by the way, the first trick we're going to talk about is this going forth of the commandment restoring to build Jerusalem. Notice that there are actually, most of your study Bibles will have three decrees footnoted that might be candidates. There's actually four, they overlook one. But the real point is, three of those four have to do with the temple. This isn't talking about the temple, it's talking about the city of Jerusalem. That turns out to be a different decree, only one. There's a very specific decree in view here. It's in Nehemiah chapter 2. Here's what, in effect, Gabriel is telling Daniel. From the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the King. Your Bible may say Messiah the Prince. The word is Nagid. It's first used of Saul. It's Messiah the King. Shall be 69 weeks of years. Now, we're indebted to Sir Robert Anderson, head of Scotland Yard, who wrote a classic piece of work in 1894 called The Coming Prince, in which he unravels this. He gets the help of the astronomers at the Royal Observatory to pin down some details. I won't go through the long version. His classic book is available in any Christian bookstore called The Coming Prince, in which he points out that God uses 360-day years. He does so in Genesis, and he does so in Revelation, among other places. So what Gabriel is saying to Daniel, there's going to be 69 times 7 times 360, or 173,880 days. If you multiply that out, what Gabriel is saying to Daniel, from the commandment restoring to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the King, shall be 173,880 days. Okay, good. Well, it turns out from history, we can see that the decree of Artaxerxes Longimanus on March 14th of 445 B.C. is the date that Jerusalem is restored. The book of Ezra deals with the troubles trying to build the temple. Cyrus had let them go home. We'll talk about that in another session. But they didn't get anywhere in Ezra. They're frustrated because they didn't have the ability to protect themselves. takes about 19 years to go by. By this time, Nehemiah is the cupbearer to the then king, which is Artaxerxes Longimanus, and he talks him into permission to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. Artaxerxes, this is all Nehemiah chapter 2. He authorizes it. Nehemiah travels, when he gets it, rides directly to Jerusalem, arrives there in the middle of the night, walks the city walls, and as they're allowed to rebuild the walls, they make some progress. The decree to rebuild the city is a specific date, March 14th to 445 BC, no problem. The real problem we've got is what on earth do we do with the Messiah the King? That's an interesting problem. Several times in Jesus' ministry, they went to take him as a king, and he wouldn't let them. He said, "Mine hour has not yet come," John 6 and some other places. But then the one day, Jesus not only permits it, he actually arranges it. He tells his disciples to go to a particular place and give them a password. They'll release a donkey. And he deliberately rides this donkey from Bethany up over the Mount of Olives into Jerusalem, riding this donkey. He is deliberately fulfilling Zechariah 9:9. In the Old Testament, book of Zechariah, verse 9, is a prophecy. It says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly riding upon an ass, upon the colt, the foal of an ass." So Jesus is deliberately riding his donkey in fulfillment of this prophecy. Now, by the way, in Luke 19 is the whole account that we call the triumphal entry. Most people read that and don't have the background to understand what's really going on. It's 4 days till Passover. It's the 10th of Nisan. All the lambs are being inspected at the temple for the coming Passover. Jesus is riding this donkey up over the hill in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is overrun with tourists because it's one of the periods of time, there's three times a year, that every able-bodied Jew had to be in Jerusalem. Passover season, it's actually Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Passover season is one of those. And the other one is Shavuot, and the other one is Feast of Tabernacles. But in any case, so there's probably a million tourists there. They've all heard about Lazarus. They're all excited. Here he comes. Here he comes, the Messiah. So they're all excited. How many of you have heard the Bible verse, "This is the day which the Lord hath made. We shall rejoice and be glad in it"? How many have heard that verse? Sure. We do it a lot. We apply it to any day. "This is the day the Lord hath made." And we can. That's okay. But that's not really what it's saying. That's one of the Hallel Psalms. And that psalm, in this context, is announcing a specific day, the day the Messiah is presenting himself. In fact, another verse of that very psalm is what they're singing here. In Luke 19, verse 38, it mentions they're singing, "Blessed be the King that cometh in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest." They're quoting, they're singing Psalm 118 as Jesus is riding this donkey. Now, you and I, whenever we as Gentiles run the risk of missing a point, the Pharisees come to our rescue. Anytime, because of our lack of Hebrew background, we may miss a point, the Pharisees underline it for us, because when they get upset, there's a reason, okay? And they're really upset, because they recognize that allowing his disciples to sing this psalm in this context is suggesting that he's the Messiah. And so they say, "Master, rebuke your disciples," because certainly he doesn't want the disciples to blaspheme. They're calling him God, the Messiah. And Jesus says to them, "I tell you that if they held their peace, the very stones would cry out." I love that phrase for a lot of reasons. Yeah, if they would hold their peace, the stones would immediately cry out. I wish they'd shut up for a minute to find out, is that a figure of speech, is it real? Whenever we go to Israel, when Lou and I take our trips to Israel, everybody that goes there will go up to the Mount of Olives up there by the. There's a great outlook for pictures. You look across the Kidron Valley, and there's the old city and the Temple Mount and all that. Everybody does that. And it's also convenient from there. Your next stop usually is Gethsemane, which happens to be at the base of the Mount of Olives, right there at the Kidron Valley. And it's very convenient. Most buses will drop you there. They'll pick you up at the bottom of the hill. What you do is you walk down this very road down to Gethsemane for the next Bible study, whatever, in Gethsemane. Before I let the guys off the bus on top of Mount of Olives, I say, by the way, let me give you a clue of the best bargain in Israel. There's all kinds of people who try to sell you all kinds of trinkets. That's fine. But here's the best bargain. While you're walking, take your pictures, whatever, but while you're walking down this road to our next stop, down at Gethsemane, reach down as you're walking and pick up a stone or two and put it in your pocket. And when you get back to the United States or wherever you come from, you get back home, you take that stone and have it mounted on a piece of walnut or something for your kitchen, or actually your living room, kitchen, den, or your office as sort of a little trophy. And when people come to visit, they say, "Gee, what's that?" You can say, that's one of the stones that didn't cry out. And so you get to go into Daniel 9, Luke 19, and they brought it up, see? I have one of these stones that I did from Megiddo. I did the same thing up at Megiddo. I had one of these in my office once with a little plaque on it. It said Revelation 16:16, which gathered them together in the place called Armageddon. And I remember I was chairman of the board of a public company that had a large software activity, and the head of the software activity was in a hurry. I was in a hurry for my reasons. He was in a hurry for his. He comes busting in my office with his long computer printout, and he had something he needed approval on. He stopped, and he saw this on my desk. He says, what's that? He says, are you ready? He says, try me. I says, well, I did do it briefly because we're both in a hurry. We both had to make different appointments. I says, well, so in about three sentences, I said something to the effect that, well, that's a stone from the battlefield in Israel that's going to be the final world battlefield where everything's good. That's one that won't be radioactive when all this happens. You know, I give blah, 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 blah. And he looked at me and says, you're right. I says, what do you mean? I wasn't ready. And he left. Anyway, for reasons I could explain, I won't take the time here, the triumphal entry has been dated April 6th of 32 A.D. Now, what's interesting about this, if you take from 445 to 30 A.B.C. to 32 A.D. is 173,740 days. And if you go through the calculation, make sure you don't allow, there's no year zero. You can't just take an algebraic. You've got to allow for a year. March 14th to April 6th is another 24 days. The leap year calculations will lead another 116. If you add up those three numbers, it adds up to 173,880 days. Or to put it simply, Gabriel predicted 5 centuries before the fact the exact day that the Messiah would present himself as a king to Jerusalem. And there's no way to escape it. It's right there in black and white. There's some technicalities you've got to get through, but they're all very well supportable. Now, to put this in perspective, the Septuagint version is virtually in the middle of this period, long before the fact. So whoever did it under what, this isn't contrived by some rabbis or well-meaning scribes, who knows. This was in black and white 3 centuries before Jesus Christ was born. And he's fulfilling this prophecy to the exact day. But we're not through yet. As Jesus comes up over the hill, and as he saw the city of Jerusalem, as he came up over the bridge, he saw Jerusalem spread. And what did he do? He wept over it. And he said, if thou hadst known, even thou at least in this thy day, the things which belong to thy peace. But now they are hidden from thine eyes. Jesus declares judicial blindness on the nation of Israel. Forever? No. Paul will tell us in Romans 11:25, it's up until the fullness of the Gentiles, until the church is complete. But this is where it's announced. But he's not through. He goes on. Jesus goes on. He says, for the day shall come upon thee that thine enemy shall cast a trench about thee and compass thee around and keep thee in on every side. And they shall lay thee even with the ground, even thy children within thee, and they shall not leave in thee one stone left upon another. And it's a matter of history that 38 years later, Titus Vespasian and the Roman legions, the 5th, 10th, 12th, and 15th Roman legions, lay siege to the city of Jerusalem, seal it off, as the Romans always did. And for 9 months there was war, and during that war, over 1 million men, women, and children were slaughtered. And subsequently, another 500,000 died from the famine and the disease from that siege. The disastrous fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., have a question. Why was Jerusalem destroyed in 70 A.D., one of the biggest milestones in Jewish history? Why was Jerusalem destroyed by the Romans in 70 A.D.? Now, you can give a lot of answers to that, different views. What's Jesus' view? He finishes Luke 19:44 with the explanation. All this is going to happen because you knew it's not the time of your visitation. Titus had hoped to keep the temple as a trophy, but some Roman soldier threw a torch through one of the windows, caught fire. Interior was wood covered with gold. It all melted from the fire, so Titus had unfortunately give orders for his soldiers to take it apart, stone by stone, to recover the gold. Literally, not one stone was left upon another. That whole prophecy of Jesus in Luke 19:44 was fulfilled, literally, 38 years later. 38 years, the same number of years that Israel wandered in the wilderness. Interesting. They never learned. Always their faithlessness. Hegel had it right. History teaches that man learns nothing from history. Again, they missed the cue. They were destroyed because they knew it's not the time of their visitation. You know the heavy part of this? Jesus held them accountable to know Daniel 9. But that we've just covered two of the verses. The next verse 26 talks about an interval. After the 62 weeks, now remember there was 7 plus 62, so after the 62 is like saying after the 69, in effect, shall the Messiah be karat, cut off, executed for a capital crime, but not for himself. Who did he die for? You and I. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, or diaspora. And unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. Daniel 9:26. This introduces an interesting player, the prince that shall come. This is one of 33 titles of the Antichrist in the Old Testament. The people of this prince that shall come in the future shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Who destroyed the city and the sanctuary? The Romans. This is why scholars take for granted that the prince that shall come shall be in some sense a Roman or a European or a Gentile or what have you. So let's continue our diagram. Verse 25 talked about 7 plus 62 weeks for the 69 weeks. We talked about that already. Verse 27 will deal with the 70th week yet forthcoming. We haven't got there yet. Between these verse 25 and 27 is verse 26, which deals with a specific interval. In that interval, there are at least two things that happen. The Messiah will be cut off, i.e., the cross. Also, the city and the sanctuary shall be destroyed. So there's at least 38 years between the end of the 69 weeks before the 70th week can start. Actually, more than that, we've experienced almost 2,000 years. We are in this interval in which Israel is set aside for God's program temporarily, where the church is being complete. This obviously is not, the diagram on the wall is not to scale. But the 70th week is yet to come. 70th week of Daniel, the most documented period of time in the entire Bible. Let's take a look at what verse 27 says. And he, that is the prince that shall come, the previously mentioned noun, the pronoun he, obviously the antecedent is the prince that shall come, shall enforce the covenant with the many, that's an idiom for Israel, for 1 week, that's the final week of Daniel 70. In the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations shall make it desolate, even unto the consummation, and that determined shall be poured out upon the desolate. He's going to enforce a covenant for 7 years, 1 week, but in the middle of that week, he's going to cause the sacrifice and the oblation that is in the temple to cease. That's why we know there'll be a temple standing. His covenant may have nothing to do with the temple, but we know the temple will be up because he will violate that temple in the middle of the week. Paul will talk a great deal about this. Both 1st and 2nd Thessalonians will deal with this in detail. And for the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate. Now, this is the 70th week. In the middle of that week, there's this desecration of the holy place that Jesus talks about. It's interesting that in the middle of Jesus' good shepherd discourse in John 10, there's this little insert, the Holy Spirit says. It was at Jerusalem at the Feast of Dedication, and it was winter. And again, if you're a well-adjusted reader, you go on and read. But if you've been to one Chuck Missler's Bible studies, you are no longer a well-adjusted reader. Because you know that Chuck says everything's there by design. Why did the Holy Spirit want you to know that it was Jerusalem, the Feast of the Dedication, and it was winter? Well, what dedicating what? The temple. Well, there's a problem here. Solomon's temple was dedicated in the autumn, 1 Kings 8:2. The subsequent second temple, Zerubbabel's temple, if you will, was dedicated in the spring in Ezra 6. When was there a dedication of the temple? In the winter. The rededication due to the contamination by Antiochus Epiphanes. And the rededication of that was in winter on the 25th of Kislev, Antiochus Epiphanes' birthday. And that is celebrated to this day by the Jews as Hanukkah. Did you know that Hanukkah was authenticated in the New Testament? Anyway, the abomination of desolation, we know a great deal about what's coming future because it's a repeat, in a sense, of what happened 2 centuries before Christ used this phrase in Matthew 24. Now, the first half of this is sometimes called by some the beginning of sorrows, but the last half of this period, this last three and a half years, is labeled by Jesus Christ himself as the Great Tribulation. He's actually quoting Daniel 12. These two halves of the week are called 3.5 years. They're called 42 months. They're called 1260 days. The Holy Spirit's gone out of his way to let us know those are literal terms. I believe Revelation chapter 6 through 19 is a detailing of what transpires during this seven-year period. Now, the 69 weeks are up. We're in the interval between the 69th and 70th, and that interval is about ready to start the clock again. There's a final 7 years on God's clock for Israel, and it's about ready to trigger off. It's interesting, if we look at all of Israel's history, it's always in 490-year periods. We talked earlier about Abraham to the Exodus was 505 years, but when you subtract the 15 years for Ishmael, you get 15 from 505, which is 490. From the Exodus to the temple is 601 years, but if you subtract the 111 years of servitude in the judges, you get, again, interesting, 490 years. From the temple to the Edict of Artaxerxes is 560 years, but you subtract the 70 for the Babylonian captivity, you get 490 years again. If you take Artaxerxes to the second coming of Jesus Christ, it's 483 years plus these 7, it's 490 years if you take the calendar and subtract out the church period, whatever it is, it'll end up being 4. It's interesting that there's four 490-year periods that make up Israel's history. I think that's an interesting observation. I think it was originally made by Clarence Larkin in 1919. A couple of quick looks here, and we'll finish it up. Daniel 10 is a glimpse of the dark side. Daniel is in a fast for 21 days. An angel is sent and shows up and tells him he was sent 21 days ago to see him, but he was held up by a conflict with some creature called the Prince of the Kingdom of Persia. And it wasn't until Michael came to help him that he could get through. He's assisted by Michael, the chief prince. The word prince here is used of angels, super angels. And he explains, I'm going to give you a vision that'll turn out to be Daniel 11 and 12. But when I'm through, I've got to go back and deal with the prince of the power of Greece. Now, this spooky little glimpse tells us a few interesting things. That apparently there's some kind of super angel of Satan's ministers for each of the major kingdoms. This angel is sent to Daniel, is held up for 21 days by the prince of the kingdom of Persia. What's going on here? Now, he can't get through until Michael comes to help him. Which he does, he comes through and gives Daniel the vision. But when he's through, he's got to go back, he knows, and fight the prince of the power of Greece. Greece is the succeeding empire to Persia. The Greek empire is 200 years away. What's going on here? Is it possible that Satan has super angels behind every one of the world empires? Who is the ruler of this world? Satan. How does he rule the world? Through his ministers. Are they visible? No. They're behind the scenes, but very powerful. Now, the other thing about this that causes a lot of comment, Daniel fasts for 21 days, and at the end of 21 days, this angel makes it through. It doesn't say this, but we can't escape the inference that the 21 days are somehow linked. I wonder if Daniel had stopped his fast at 20 days or 19. Would the angel have gotten through? I don't know. But many scholars suspect that one reason we don't have a deeper communication with the host that would help us is because we don't take this warfare seriously. Daniel did. And he's given Daniel 11 and 12, which is a detailed profile of the subsequent kings of the Seleucid and Ptolemaic dynasties confronting one another. And it includes a detailed glimpse of the final world ruler that will prevail to the end. There's a lot in there, but we're going to take that up as a separate topic later in these series. Prophecy is a major part of the Bible. According to J. Barton Payne, his Encyclopedia of Biblical Prophecy, he has cataloged 8,362 verses that are predictive in nature that cover over 1,800 predictions on over 700 different matters. Prophecy is real. Now, if you go through these themes, you'll discover there's major themes in prophecy. There's all kinds of prophecies about Israel. If you want to know what time it is on God's clock, you look at Israel. And Jerusalem. Zechariah says Jerusalem will be a bone in the throat for the world until the Messiah comes. Do you notice that Jerusalem is in the major news lately? While we're having this conference here, the late lights are burning in every capital on the planet Earth trying to struggle what to do about Jerusalem. Exactly like Zechariah 12 details, which is a preposterous prophecy. Why should any city, in Zechariah, he predicts that it's going to be the major fulcrum of the entire earth. That's ridiculous. Here's a city that has no natural resources, no rivers, no harbor, has no reason to be strategically significant. It's not on any caravan routes or whatever that matter today. Why should the whole world care, for crying out loud? It's important to some Jews, not all of them. The Muslims had it for 1,000 years and let it turn into rubble until they discovered it's important to the Jews. Then it became very important to Islam. It's important to Christians to visit, but not to die for. And yet Zechariah predicts that the entire world is going to go to war, nuclear war, over Jerusalem. Zechariah 12. All the nations of the earth will come up against Jerusalem. Zechariah predicts. And we sit here today, and the newspapers will not let go of the fact that they're somehow going to try to solve Jerusalem when it gets serious. There'll be no peace until the Prince of Peace comes. I won't start on that. Let's go on. The temple will be rebuilt. Because how do we know? Because Jesus, Paul, and John all make reference to it standing when Jesus comes back. Babylon is going to be rebuilt. It's already Saddam Hussein has already started. Russia is going to invade, and boy, are they in for a surprise. The rise of China is a superpower in Isaiah 49 and Revelation 16. Europe is emerging as a super state, a reemergence, or at least preparing for a reemergence of what may be phase two of the vision that Daniel had in Daniel 2 and 7. And while this is going on, there's an ecumenical movement to establish a one-world religion. And while this is going on, there's a move towards a global government for lots of reasons. And while all this is going, there's the rise of the occult. Interesting times. Here's your challenge, my friends. Don't accept what I'm putting on the screen, but challenge it. Here's my view, that we are being plunged into a period of time about which the Bible says more than it does about any other period of time in human history, including the time that Jesus walked the shores of Galilee or climbed the mountains of Judea. That's a preposterous statement. Don't accept it. Challenge it. You've got to be kidding. Yes, I believe we are being plunged into a period of time about which the Bible says more than it does about even the gospel period. Now, how do you challenge a statement like that? You've got to do two things. You got to find out what the Bible says about these things. And then, you got to find out what's going on. And you won't find out on the 10 o'clock news. The managed media is proud of its ability to shape public opinion, not inform it. The free press is the thing of the past. The leadership of our main media takes pride in their ability to determine election outcomes. If you want to find out, if you're a professional in any field, you don't rely on the managed media. You go to specialized publications that cater to your particular interest. If you're interested in world affairs, subscribe to foreign publications, The Economist, The London Telegraph, whatever, and take them with a grain of salt too, but they have the reputation that the New York Times used to have years ago. Find out. With the Internet, that's wonderful. It's an end run on the whole managed media circus. You can find out what's going on, but take the effort and find out what's really going on. The more you know about the biblical scenario and the more you know about what's going on in the world, the more you'll come to the view that we're living on the threshold of God's greatest climax for mankind in history. Now, the ultimate issue is as follows. You and I are in possession of a message of extraterrestrial origin. Can you imagine? And it portrays you and I as objects of an unseen warfare. We're both the pawns and the prize in this cosmic warfare. And our eternal destiny, yours and mine, depend entirely not on what church you go to, not what your heritage is, not what cultural background, entirely upon your personal relationship with the ultimate victor in this cosmic conflict. Where do you stand with respect to him?